This is the Fun, Food and Fitness Podcast, where I have real conversations about how people navigate BS and establish a healthy relationship with food, exercise and their bodies. So welcome to the Fun, Food and Fitness Podcast. My name is Emma and today I'm really, really excited to be speaking with my friend Rachel, who's a powerlifter. And we've been connected for, I think, quite a long time now. I'm not sure how long we're together, but yeah, kind of have a lot in common in terms of attitudes towards kind of lifting and yeah, sort of strong opinions about what we see on social media, etc. That we'll, I'm sure, get into. So welcome to the podcast, first of all, Rachel.
Hello.
Obviously, we have kind of worked together a bit as well, but I think it'd be really useful just to start with kind of how you got into fitness.
So my kind of fitness journey is like super long.
That's right, we've got time.
It's like a bit of a chunk of talking. But I've really been into exercise for the majority of my life. So when I was a bit younger, sort of in school and stuff, I really enjoyed swimming. I swam kind of competitively, sort of from like the kind of secondary school age. So I did like galas for my town and stuff, and I really loved being in the water. And really from there, like, I stopped swimming for a bit when I got to teenage, kind of, you know, 14. And you go through that time as a teenager sort of being, I don't know, I guess when you get to that time of your life, you feel like very unsure of what you want to do and what you like, and you want to try different things, etc. So I stopped sort of competing at that point, but then I got back into fitness again when I was sort of 17 and I started to go to the gym a little bit. And like, that was something sort of I did on and off through like my late teens to early 20s. And then I really got into fitness per se properly when I started my first sort of job out of uni. I was about 25 and I think what made me go, which is slightly shameful, but I gained a little bit of weight from like being on a desk job, which happens to a lot of people.
Yeah,
I think when you go from being like quite active through uni and walking around a lot, and like, I know through uni I did like a bar job as well, so I was absolutely tiny. I didn't really eat loads. I didn't really have time to. And then I kind of started working on a desk job, and I got to the point where I wasn't like really unhappy with my body, but there were things that I wanted to change, and I kind of saw going to the gym as like a fix for that. And I think at that point I started looking on like Instagram in its kind of early days. So probably when I first sort of saw Instagram, it would have been about 27, I think. So that's what, 4 years ago. So it would have been like 2015 or something when I started looking on Instagram. And I just gradually sort of got more and more into the world of like lifting weights. And I saw people online. I know I got very inspired by like, they're not on YouTube as this anymore, but it was Vegan Fitness. And I saw... they're now Family Fizz, I think. But I saw the mum, Georgie, doing her first bodybuilding competition. And I got, like, super inspired by seeing her lose a lot of weight. And, you know, really changing the way she looked. So I then decided to diet myself, because I went to the gym and things. And, you know, I kind of was, like, seeing my body change a little bit, but not loads. And I was like, oh, right, I need to eat better. So I think at the beginning of that, it was quite positive, because they put out a lot of healthy recipes, and like, I was sort of tracking my nutrition, but not really. I was just sort of trying to eat well. So sort of fuel myself for the gym and make sure I was getting a good amount of protein for my meals and things like that. So that was all sort of well and good. And then at the beginning of 2017, I kind of like, I've been like eating better, and like I'd seen again small changes, but I hadn't really seen like the big changes that maybe I wanted to make at that point. So I then kind of signed up to one of these online fitness influencers, and I made a New Year's resolution that I was going to lose 0.5 stone, and I went on like a cut, and I did like a kind of beauty building guide. Sorry, I'm like in hysterics because this is like the polar opposite of like, how I am now.
Yeah, but if you go on Instagram, like, yeah, people will understand, yeah.
But like, but I was kind of at that point, I guess you have to go through things to get to a good place, and that was sort of the start of, you have to go down to go back up again sometimes.
Yeah.
And that was sort of like, yeah, I mean, the cuts that I did, I used like a template, and I didn't realise at this point, but the template and my body were definitely not compatible at all. I've kind of since come to realise that my maintenance is pretty high, which is like, obviously it's quite good, but it meant at the time when I was calculating, I was getting a much lower maintenance than I actually had. So of course, when you calculate your maintenance low, you end up dieting on very, very low calories. And I mean, my experience of dieting at this point was so hard. I mean, I was falling off the wagon quite a lot, but still losing weight. I was kind of sticking to it, and then I'd be like, we'd have refeed days, and I'd go way over the refeed, basically. I was so hungry. And then I think I'd been doing this for maybe 3 months, and like, we had kind of monthly check-ins with this influencer, and it was decided that I hadn't lost enough weight, or that I hadn't lost the weight that I should be losing, obviously, because I was going over, because I was eating too much in my refeeds, but never mind. She was like, no, we need to drop the calories to lose the stubborn fat.
Oh, God.
So I ended up on maybe 1,500 calories a day. And my maintenance at this point is about 2,200. So that's a very big deficit. And at that point, some very kind of negative things started to happen. Like, I wasn't sleeping properly, because I would be not only hungry during the night, so I was waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning, like very, very, very hungry. But also I was getting so, so cold. I was like shivering all over. So I'd wake up at 4 in the morning, starving hungry and freezing cold. I was having to make my cardio more and more aggressive, to try and get to this weight loss goal. So I was doing things like hill sprints, like for 20 minutes, and then doing a full, I'd do those in the morning, and then I'd go and do this full, kind of upper body or lower body split. And, it was kind of high reps, lots of sets, lots of super sets, giant sets, the works, really.
Yeah.
So I was working very, very hard on not a lot. And at that point, I think, you can't really go on that long. I got like 3 weeks into this deficit, and I just absolutely had enough. I think I maybe bought some, like, not even like, the typical binge foods, but like things like, protein bars and like kind of treat, like, those Lenny's and Larry's cookies and things like that. I had those. And I think one afternoon I had like a little stash, and I ate everything. And I was like, when you're so hungry, it's almost like nothing can satisfy you, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Nothing can satisfy you, and you just eat and you eat and you eat. And it doesn't even matter what you're eating. you know, I was eating things like just slices of bread with nothing on it, or like, you know, frozen fruit on the out the packet on its own, you know, like just weird stuff, just because I was so hungry. And I sat down afterwards and I felt awful. I felt like my stomach was literally going to explode. And I felt like, I sat there and I thought to myself, I feel like I have an eating disorder, or I feel like my whole body is a mess. I don't know when I'm hungry. I don't know when I'm full. It's kind of, it's got to this point that can't go on. And at that point, I started to look into this a bit more, because kind of what I was experiencing, it actually happens to a lot of people post-show when they do like bodybuilding. These very like uncontrolled waves of hunger. So the kind of the consensus of what I've read was to do a reverse diet. And I'm happy to say that the reverse diet was pretty successful. I actually lost more weight reversing my diet than I did dieting. So when I was eating like 1800, 1900, 2000 calories, I was losing weight each time I upped the calories, because I was sticking to it. And you know, like the sort of those weird waves of hunger were not happening as often, and I was finding that I was able to kind of satiate myself a little bit better. So after my reverse diet, you know, I thought about bulking, but honestly, I just went to a point where I kind of ate what I wanted for a while. And then I thought to myself, like, you know, originally, like, when I'd seen and got into this, my goal was very much based around bodybuilding and the hopes of becoming a bodybuilder one day. But having kind of experienced that hideous state of hunger that I'd felt, I pretty much knew I did not want to feel like that again. And I was sort of pondering to myself, I was like, what else can I do? You know, like, I wanted to compete in something that expressed my love of lifting weights, because like the gym is, well, was and still is at this point, like, my favorite place. Like, I loved being able to lift. I liked being able to feel strong. And I was doing like various programs, and I found like a sort of one that was like, you know, rather than lifting in sets of 12 and 15, I did like sets of 6, and I was like, I enjoy this so much more. And then at that point, I sort of discovered a couple of people who are powerlifting. So one of them was Meg Squats. So I followed her, and I followed her journey when she did her USA Nationals. And I saw on, admittedly on YouTube, but kind of what a powerlifting meet was like. And it blew me away. And I was also following another girl who, in the UK, was competing in my division in the UK, what would be my division in the UK, called Strongly Lizzie Mills on Instagram. I was following her, and I saw her do her junior nationals. And I watched sort of both of those, and I was like, this is really, really cool. Like, it doesn't matter how you look in this sport. Like, you have a goal to do the best you can on the platform and lift as much as you can. And that really appealed to me. And also, I, like, on the kind of program I was running, I had like a little bit of bench press, like not just dumbbell press like you would on a typical booty building sort of upper lower split, but some actual benching. And I really, really liked that. And like the squat and the deadlift, I enjoyed deadlifting as well. And the squat, you know, I quite enjoyed, but probably not as much as the other two. And I was like, you know what, with the right training, I could probably get into this. So I had a coach. Admittedly, if I went back and did it again, I probably would have put more time and effort into finding a coach. But I literally went through Instagram, and I was still very much in a mentality of like, you know, I still want to look good. even if I'm lifting heavy, and I pick someone whose physique I admired, mm-hmm. which is not the right way to choose a powerlifting coach at all. But I was, you know, I was very naive and didn't know a whole lot about the sport at this point. So I did that, and I joined a gym that sort of catered more towards powerlifting, and I started running this program. So that's sort of like how I got into powerlifting per se. It was a very strange introduction to the sport. Like the first few months were quite difficult. Like although I had a very big passion for the sport, my technique in everything other than the bench press needed a lot of work, and I hired a coach off Instagram, and like the amount of work and the type of work I needed to do, it just wasn't the right fit. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not gonna sit here and throw someone under the bus. That's not how I want to be, but you know, I probably should have like gone for in person or chosen someone with a lot more experience to deal with the type of issues that I was having. Like I was sort of dealing with like quite extreme like lumbar flexion, so to everyone that's like the cat back on the deadlift. And it definitely wasn't a simple fix. Like I still have it sometimes now, but at least I kind of know how to alleviate it, whereas then I had no idea, and my coach didn't really either. And then I had kind of issues on the squat as well. Like one of my legs turned out more than the other, and like I had issues like losing tension on the way down. I didn't know how to brace properly, like all of these things. So at that point, sort of 4 months in, I realized I really wasn't getting anywhere with it. So I thought to myself, I'm gonna look elsewhere and see if I can work with someone else. So I started working with someone else, and like the kind of the fixing of all the technique has taken a little while, but I'm happy to say that my technique has come on leaps and bounds since I started working with this person that I'm working with now. And I've competed 4 times and soon to be 5th.
Yeah, that's
how I got here, basically. I'm sorry if it sounds a little bit negative, but
no.
It's just been like a real whirlwind, and like I'm really grateful to have gone through the things I have, because it's taught me a lot, and I have a lot more knowledge for it. So yeah.
So thank you so much for sharing that. And it's really interesting, like, of all the kind of interviews I've done, like, the vast majority of people have had some kind of a struggle, like, either during fitness or, like, kind of almost before they got into the kind of fitness and stuff. So I think it's so common. And I think,
yeah,
I think, like you said, sometimes you almost have to have some kind of struggles and things to actually find this balance, you know. I think, and it is, you know, it's really difficult to navigate this stuff. I think, you know, if you're in a place definitely. Where you are quite vulnerable, you know, there are, you know, we know there's a lot of crap on Instagram, you know, and elsewhere, right? Oh, yeah. So, and it seems, you know, it seems very attractive when you're not feeling great, say, about your body or whatever, that, you know, someone is. And yeah, I think it's, you know, it is really hard. And I think, you know, obviously it's fantastic you're in, you know, a good place now, I think. But yeah, I think that story is common, that people do have these, you know, definitely these struggles. And yeah, I mean, the whole like fitness influencer thing, I think it's just, yeah, it's such a mess, isn't it? Because I think,
yeah,
I have no problem with someone sharing like, this is what makes me happy, this is what I enjoy, whatever. But I think it's then when they're coaching other people, I think that's when there can be some, you know, yeah, bad things that happen, basically.
I think there are kind of like two sort of main issues that I kind of see, and the first is like the cookie cutter template, which I followed, But, you know, I think my program, there were 2,000 women all doing the same thing.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, now when I have a program for my coach that's written just for me, that focuses on my weak points, and that helps me address them. And I've seen such improvements from going to a more cookie cutter based program to going to something completely individual. And I think it applies to people when they're buying like templates like 531 or other things in powerlifting. Like, you know, you can have a good program, but you don't know if that's going to be good for you because it's not written for you. If that makes sense.
Yes, completely. And the same with night nutrition, like you were saying, right? Like, yeah, you can plug your numbers and age and activity level into a calculator, but that won't necessarily be right for you. Like, it could be a ballpark, but you know what? It could be way off. Like, that's,
yeah,
that's possible too. And I think, yeah, I don't know. It's hard because I think people want some like simple kind of, this is what I need to do, you know, but it's just not like that. Things are nuanced and complex and change over time as well, depending on where you are and what your goals are.
I think so. And like, yeah, when you say about like change over time, I think there's a very kind of, you know, there's a kind of idea out there that you'll stop powerlifting and you'll be getting a PR every week and you'll just progress upwards and upwards and upwards. And a few months into my journey, another powerlifter that I follow said to me, you know progress isn't linear, because I was saying I'm not making any progress, and she said, well, progress isn't linear.
Yeah,
powerlifting's not linear, it takes time, and sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards. I mean, particularly when you're dealing with like issues and technique and things like that, you have to drop down to a lower weight and work on technique in order to build it back up again. And like, the majority of what I do in the gym is like nowhere near my max at all. I'm just, you know, my coach is very much trying to drill a good technique into me and prepare me so that when the weight gets heavy, like my formal stay, it's not going to break down. So yeah, we have, I think like sometimes the expectations or the things that are shown on Instagram aren't always entirely the truth.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting about powerlifting, actually, because I don't actually follow a lot of powerlifters, but that isn't something that I, yeah, necessarily thought about that also being kind of a highlight reel. I definitely see it with more like physique-oriented sort of Instagrams, but that's really interesting.
No, I think there definitely is a strength highlight reel. You know, I know of people who will only post when they PR, or if they're doing like, obviously we work in kind of different phases. So we do hypertrophy because, you know, in order to be strong you need a lot of muscle. So you will do a hypertrophy block, and a lot of powerlifters will say like, oh, I've got nothing interesting to post at the moment because I'm doing volume, because I'm doing hypertrophy, and like the weight's not that high and it's not interesting. But I think like by only showing your PRs, or when you're only going heavy, you're putting a kind of a false idea of what we do out there a little bit. I mean, not necessarily deliberately, but you know, if you're only posting your PRs and not talking about the struggles that are associated, because the sport, you know, you do have to really go through some shitty times.
Yeah.
You know, even people at top level, you know, they'll have plateaus, they'll have injuries, they'll have like kind of niggles that are coming up, or they'll start having, as the weight progresses upwards, they'll start having like form breakdown and things like that. And I think sometimes like on Instagram you can look through all these people and think, oh wow, like they're so so strong and they never have any struggles. I think most of us have had some kind of a struggle, or really have to work through something at some point. And the very strong people, I think Marissa Inder posted the other day, she's a an extremely top-level powerlifter in the US. She was actually beaten by Joy, our UK powerlifter, top-level powerlifter in the under 52 category. She was beaten by Joy at Worlds, IPF Worlds this year. But like, she's awesome, and she posted today on her Instagram, and she said, "This journey's taken me 22 years." And I was thinking, you know, she is super strong, but it's taken her a long, long time to get to that level. It didn't happen overnight, for sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something we all need to remind ourselves, I think, because it's human to want progress and want it to be noticeable and want it to be quick. Like, that is, it's so natural, but like you say, it's not how it works. And I think that thing about things not being linear is just so important, you know, that having not only times where you're not making forward progress, but you might even be taking, you know, what you see as a kind of backward step, you know, but in the long run we'll just we'll kind of work out. And I think it's a shame. I do think things are changing a little bit on social media. I definitely think that people are getting a bit kind of fatigued by this highlight reel. So I am hopeful that people are kind of, you know, hopefully trending towards that. Because I also think about, you know, say some of these accounts, if you didn't really know much about powerlifting and you just saw that, you think, I'll give this a go myself. Right, so every day, one rep maxes, here we go. I mean, that's the recipe for injury. Yeah, probably. And you can see why, right? I want to lift as most as possible, so let's do that as often as possible. Do you know what I mean? You know, you could see the logic. But
you end up with a Snaptel 4 or L5, like in your back spine or something, and you end up horrifically injured. That has happened.
Which
people try to 1RM a lot and hurt themselves at the beginning.
Exactly. And I think, you know, these things could take months or, you know, potentially even years to kind of recover from or whatever. So I think it is important. And I think, I mean, again, you know, with Instagram, I do think, you know, people should be able to post what they want, obviously. But I do think you do have to take responsibility for what you do post. And even if your intention is to help people, I do think we need to all be kind of looking at ourselves kind of critically and thinking, actually, does this have the potential to do harm? You know, and be real about that, you know, because I think it's, I don't know, it's easy to think, oh, well, you know, it's not my responsibility how people respond and people need to do their own research. But you know what, like, it is a public platform. Anyone can see Instagram. You don't even need an account, right? You could just go onto someone's page. It could be like a child. It could, do you know what I mean? It could be anything. And, you know, I don't know. I don't think you can get out of taking responsibility, you know. I think if you have an Instagram and it's a public one, if it's private, that's different, I think. But if it's public, I think you do have responsibility to, you know, to think about what you post, you know.
For sure. I mean, and on nutrition as well, because that is somewhere I do see some worrying things. I mean,
yes.
And there are posts by people with huge followings, and they align themselves as being, you know, science-based, evidence-based, critical. Yeah, I think it was just an example of someone who had quite a large following, and he kind of said some things that maybe were not true about eating disorders, kind of saying they're an issue of energy balance and people use them as an excuse. And I just thought it was a really disgusting thing to say.
Oh my God.
And like, a lot of other people clearly felt the same as me, because he had to delete his post. But if someone vulnerable looks at that, I mean, you know, that could have quite bad consequences.
Absolutely.
I mean, I do try. I mean, I don't have a huge following, so I do try not to write things that might upset someone else or have a negative impact on them, because I think it's important just to, I know we can't get everything right, like 100% of the time, because we're human, but just some sort of thought of what we're putting out there
definitely,
you know, probably would go a long way.
I agree. And be aware of kind of what we don't know, you know, because I think what we see is like a lot of like essentially like Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Which is where people know very little but don't realise how much they don't know. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So they're like, oh, you know, I know a little bit about this, therefore I'm an expert in this. And really, like, no, you know, I hate the term expert in general, to be honest. But, you know, I think everyone has maybe an area of expertise, but that doesn't mean you should be talking about everything, right? I mean, it's like for me, say I'm a qualified like PT, but that means my knowledge is fairly low, right? You know, I wouldn't be, you know, making sort of particular recommendation if someone had a particular kind of injury, like that would be more the realm of like physiotherapy, you know. So I, you know, and it's so important to know like what you can talk about and in a way what you aren't really qualified to talk about, you know. And I think the problem is we have with things like social media is I think things like followers and also how you look are seen as being credibility. You know, it was really interesting, actually. I don't know if you saw, but on a comment I left on someone else's account about a sort of science, whatever, a response to that, that was sort of saying basically like, oh, you obviously don't know what you're talking about because you don't have that many followers and you basically don't like look like you're into fitness, you know. And so, but it was really interesting that I was like, so wait a minute. So I'm a qualified personal trainer. I've got 3 degrees, but I don't know what I'm talking about because of how I look. Oh, and that was the other thing that I didn't show before and after pictures of my clients. So obviously that meant I didn't know anything. So I think, you know, that's what I mean.
And it's calming here.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so we've got these bizarre metrics of what is credibility. And again, I'm, you know, always try and be careful about saying there is absolutely nothing wrong with sharing your personal experience. That is valuable. That honesty is really valuable. You know, this is what is working for me. This is what hasn't. This is what I enjoy. You know, that's fine. But I think it's when there's this kind of, well, this is what the science says, that's when there's the problem, because I think it's, we now have a lot of pseudoscience where it's kind of easy, you know, we'll throw in the word insulin and then we must know what we're talking about, you know, and, you know, throw around the word dopamine or, you know, whatever. So something that sounds sciencey.
An authoritative tone. And
yes.
That makes you an expert just by using some language that says, I know this and science says, so science says that it must be true, or, you know.
Yes, it's true, isn't it? And even someone that say like will sort of reference studies or whatever, like I'm again, I think I won't say who again, not wanting to throw under a bus, but there's a sort of vegan kind of doctor who a lot of people sort of follow and things like that, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, and and will post kind of basically cherry picks research and also kind of, I would say, inflates the strength of research findings, but people trust him because he posts references, but people clearly don't read them, because I say to people, like, have you actually read the studies to see actually whether it matches up with what he's saying? But people don't. It's it's trustworthy because, well, you know, he's a doctor and, well, you know, he posts references, and it's I do think we have definitely an issue there, I think.
Yeah, and like there's obviously I'm a researcher like by day job, and obviously I don't do like scientific research or anything, but you know that you have to consider when you look at these headlines of like, you know, I mean it could be about anything, but you know, claims that I don't know, celery juice cures acne or something, that was one that I saw that got debunked this week, but you have to look at sort of like the sample sizes and how the test was conducted, you know, because you can't control for every single factor in someone's life.
No.
Like, yeah, but, you know, they could drink celery juice and find they have reduced acne, but then at the same time, they might be experiencing less stress.
Yes.
So it's like, we will almost believe something because it's a paper, but I think it's important to sort of use multiple sources or look at the sample sizes or look at the methodology used, things like this, which on an Instagram post, there's not room in the caption for that kind of stuff.
No. No, it is true. And even, like, look if it was done in humans, because how much research actually do we talk about and it's done in, like, rats, you know? I mean, 95% of the research on intermittent fasting, right? So, we know a lot about intermittent fasting in rats. You know, that's not necessarily that helpful for humans. And like you say, we can't control all the factors, especially with humans, because we don't live in labs. Do you know what I mean? We have all these different things, hormones, emotions, all these different things that in a way we can't sort of possibly control for. So no, I think that's so important. And like you said as well, not just using one study, because yes, one study is helpful, but it's in the context of the larger body of evidence, And when you were talking about the celery thing, it reminded me, there's a Carl Sagan quote, which is one of my favourite quotes, that is, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, which I think, if people sort of, thought about that, would actually perhaps be a little more sceptical of these kind of headlines, in certainly particular newspapers and things like that, and think about actually, because I find often actually it's not even the study or the actual researchers that are actually making that claim. It's usually journalists who have maybe read a very small sample, if any, of the actual study, then turn it into a catchy headline. Exactly.
With newspaper studies as well, I mean, I've worked in research for PR, and, the way that they're commissioned, I mean, obviously, you can't make up scientific research, but there was a study that I saw today, which was vegans take more time sick off work than regular people. And so this was published in the Daily Mirror, and it was based on a study that had been done, I can't remember the company that commissioned the research, but you have to bear in mind when you're reading them that the research that they do, so it's usually an online poll. So this was an online sample of 1,000 office workers. And this research is done specifically to generate a headline. So, when it's written up and when the questions are written, it's designed to get a headline out of it.
Yes.
And you've got to think, in a sample of 1,000 office workers, how many of them are going to be vegan, and is that statistically valid?
Yeah.
Because if you've got 5 vegans and 95 non-vegans,
yeah,
that's not enough people to make that claim.
Absolutely. No, it's so true. And I mean, there's the idea of like publication bias as well. So if something doesn't produce a catchy headline, right, it's actually less likely to get published in a scientific journal, so we have that kind of issue as well. And I think it's so important to to consider these things. And I think as well, acknowledge our own biases, because I don't believe we can be free from bias. I think but I think what we can do is acknowledge them and kind of put them aside when we're looking at research, because obviously we're sort of both vegans and things, and I do see particularly sometimes within veganism there's this reluctance to see anything that against veganism, must be bullshit. Do you know what I mean? I think, maybe it is, but we can't just throw it out just because we would like to see that veganism is always the most healthiest, everyone should do it, it's good for... We want that, and that would be great. And I think we do have evidence that certainly you can be healthy as a vegan, absolutely. But we need to be open-minded to the research, whatever it happens to say,
And we need to be able to act on it as well. There are some very valid negative findings in veganism. Such as B12.
Yes.
I mean, this is something I sort of try and post about periodically on my account, just because, B12 deficiency is a hideous thing, and it's entirely avoidable because supplements are available everywhere. Even in Switzerland, where I now live, I find some in the organic store. But, there's a lot, certainly from what I've seen in vegan groups, there's a lot of people saying, just eat unwashed vegetables, or you know, oh, I don't need to supplement with B12, or it's a natural diet, I can get what I need from eating fruit, or these kinds of things. And, yes, you know, there's evidence that says that, you know, there's issues with B12 in vegan diets, simply because people don't supplement or don't consider it enough.
Yes, yeah, I agree. And it's interesting, I was talking about this a bit with Karina Inkster, who I had on a podcast, which hasn't been aired yet, but my undergraduate dissertation, I looked at, like, online forums, online kind of vegan, I think it was a vegan fitness forum when, back in the day when forums were sort of, you know, big. It was, what I looked at was health concerns that were raised by people and the way that people responded to them. So I was doing a kind of discursive analysis, like really looking at actually just the language and things that people used. And it was exactly what you said. It was people that were saying, oh, do I have to worry about things like B12? You know, what about this? And basically nearly all the responses were, don't worry about it, just eat whatever you want, it will be fine. You know, they were so reluctant to even say, you know what, you do have to be careful about this, think about supplementing this. Again, you know, go for it, you can absolutely be healthy, but you do have to think about it, you can't do it mindlessly and hope for the best, you know. It was interesting, and I think that we do definitely still have that. I think where this, you know, it's hard, isn't it? Because I think, you know, it's great there's more out about veganism, and obviously, you know, we do want to kind of show that actually, yeah, you can be healthy, you can be strong, do you know what I mean? You can do all these things as a vegan, but, you know, it's a reality. With our modern world, you do have to take supplements, you know. Probably if you're not a vegan, it's still a good idea, right? For certain supplements, vitamin D, for example, right? I mean,
B12 in some
Yeah, well, exactly.
You have people who have a better absorption of the vitamin than others.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, I think that is something I do still see, and I think that is starting to change a little bit, but I do think that is something that is still an issue. And again, I think it's that trying to be mindful, you know, of our own sort of our own kind of biases and things, and, you know, being willing to be wrong. You know, no one likes to be wrong, but sometimes, you know, we all will be, you know, at some point, you know, and we just, you know, acknowledge that, and, you know, if there were other people involved, you know, also communicate that to them, you know. It's like, you know, going back to, like, with Instagram, I mean, if people did that, like, no problem, do you know what I mean? Someone said, do you know what, I did this, I was wrong, really sorry about that, and, you know, I've learnt my lesson going forward. But I never see that.
I never see that either. I mean, people just delete it.
Yes.
They don't acknowledge that maybe what they put out was wrong, and, you know, change that story. And actually, you know, if you just delete something, if people have already read it,
yeah,
they're not going to know any better necessarily.
No. And the thing is, just, I honestly, I don't judge anyone that was wrong about something. I think, you know, we all do the best we can with what we know. And, you know, but we do have a responsibility when that changes, you know, particularly if you have a big audience, to, you know, to communicate that, you know. And actually, you know, I'd have a lot of respect for someone that has the, you know, has the guts to say, you know what, I was wrong, and I'm sorry, you know.
Definitely, it would be a nice thing to see more of, I think. I know as well, I'd appreciate it as a viewer, if I was told something and then found out it was wrong, and the person who did it admitted their mistakes. I mean, I'm just thinking of, like, a few times, you know, people have been given misinformation and found out it's wrong later. Of course, there's a certain type of diet within veganism that I could use as a great example of eating bananas. And, you know, still, it just kind of died down, but no one has sort of owned it and said, maybe actually it's not the right way to eat for everybody.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe we shouldn't be promoting this as the only way to be a vegan, because there are a lot of ways to be a vegan, and a lot of types of diet, you know, make up of macronutrients or the like, that you can do. It's not like a one-size-fits-all. No. And the same with nutrition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it can change, you know, change over time, I think, and, you know, all sorts of things. And I think, that was definitely a problem. And I think particularly people that were doing it and thinking that was a kind of long, I mean, it's not good in the short term, but I mean, as long term, it's going to be an absolute car crash, you know, for your health. So, I do definitely still see that there's this kind of assumption that veganism is this one sort of thing, and it's this kind of, I see more the kind of, it's the health thing that people think, oh, it's eating just, you know, fruit and veg, or do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, you know, you cannot be healthy as a vegan. That's like your prerogative, right? It's an ethical choice. You know, absolutely there are ways to do it healthily, and you know, within that huge variety in what, you know, and what you can have, I think. So but you know, like we were saying, it does have to involve supplements, you know, that is the the reality of it. Not a lot, right? But you know, a few to make sure that you're healthy. And in, you know, in the same way that I would often recommend, you know, for people who aren't vegan, just, you know, we live in a very different time now, you know, we're not hunter and gatherers, despite what, you know, paleo enthusiasts might might propose. You know, we don't, you know, go out and just, you know, pick, you know, fruit and veg from, you know, trees on the ground and stuff, so we, you know, we do have to, you know, account for that.
Oh, definitely.
See, and I said I wasn't going to throw people under the bus, but whoops. <Yeah. laughs> But it's all right.
There's always a chance to change your opinion, and I've done that many, many times. You know, like when I was talking about my fitness journey, what I see as a goal now is certainly very different from what I saw as a goal a couple of years ago. And my method for doing it, and like the way that I eat actually has changed, you know. I was very much focusing on dieting and losing weight, and the goal now is really just to fuel myself properly, to train to the best of my ability and do as well as I can in the gym. So, you know, I could probably look back at my old self and say, you know what, you probably were wrong, and, you know, probably not the best attitude to have towards fitness.
But sometimes you need that, you know, experience to get where, you know, where you are now, where you know how to eat to fuel your training, but also you're not afraid of having foods that are just, like, taste nice, right? And I think, you know, that sounds easy on paper, but I think often we have to go around the houses to kind of actually find what that looks like for us, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when I finished dieting, I was terrified of certain foods, because, you know, I've been obsessively counting macros, like to the point of where I wanted to be within a gram of every macro every day, and have to hit my calories perfectly. And that was like my sort of target that I wanted. And, you know, when you try and fit things like ice cream into your macros, you have to take it out and weigh it and all of that. And I think I felt like if I didn't track, or I ate some of these foods that maybe didn't have a great macronutrient profile, that, like, I just go off the rails. And it's not necessarily true, because I think I haven't properly tracked in nearly a year. And like, my weight's a little bit higher because I probably put on some muscle. But, you know, I don't sit there and eat a pint of Ben and Jerry's at a time. You know, I thought I would, but then I find that when it's not forbidden, or like when my amount that I can have of something or frequency is not restricted, it's much easier just to sort of have a little bit and feel really satisfied and think, oh, great. And, you know, you want to base your meals on things that will, again, fuel my training. So I want, like, my carbohydrates, and I want my micros and things, and my protein. And I do think about that, but if I fancy a bit of ice cream, I'll have it. And there's never a temptation to eat the whole thing. Maybe after a competition I did once, but I regretted it shortly after.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's an amazing place to be. And I think, you know, it does often take, you know, take kind of work to get there, you know, particularly I think with the fitness industry, there was this real kind of, I don't know, yeah, push for this macros, you know, everyone should be tracking, do it as accurately as possible, you know, and I think...
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, and it led people to think that they couldn't just trust themselves around food,
yeah.
You know, that they thought that actually if they didn't track, then they would just go, you know, AWOL, basically, you know, and I think there are still people that believe that. There was a girl I was speaking with the other day, and talking about some kind of, I don't know, treat food or whatever, and she was like, oh, I can only have it once a week because I overeat it. And I thought, no. You, like, the reason you overeat it is because you only allow yourself to have it once a week, you know. But it was, you know, couldn't sort of see that. So, yeah, and I think it is often something people have to experience to believe, I think, actually, that they will get to a place where, you know what, again, they might have some times where, you know, they have, you know, might overeat a bit or whatever because something looks good on a menu or at someone's birthday or whatever, you know. Yeah. But actually... there's not this drive, you know, particularly like you were talking about when you just finished, you know, your cut, where it was just like you were just so hungry for anything. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, I think, it's hard because I think when people have been stuck in this kind of sort of restrictive mindset for a long time, they just don't believe that they can just be normal around food, you know, and but, you know, you absolutely can with, you know, with work, definitely. And, you know, time and patience. And I think, like with you, also be really successful if you want athletically, because I sometimes think people think, oh, you know, with intuitive eating, yeah, it's all right for like general health and all this, but actually, you know what, you can be really successful without doing that. And I think you're kind of evidence of that, you know. Sophia that I kind of interviewed is evidence of that, you know. Nearly all the people actually that I've spoken to don't track, you know, macro strictly, but are also smashing it with their fitness goals, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, like, in like my example, and I know Sophia does this as well, tracking is very useful for short-term goals.
Yeah,
I mean, it can be a good tool for short-term goals, definitely. I don't want to say that no one should ever track,
no,
but like, you know, if you want to make weight for a competition and maybe you're sitting a kilogram over or something, and you want to slowly get that down, or you know, you just want to know, like, day to day what you're consuming, where that is for your maintenance. I'm not afraid to use tracking in the short term for that purpose.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think that's how it should be seen. It's like a tool, right? And, you know, you might want to, I don't know, track protein, for example. Like, if you were, say, new to veganism, might be worth tracking that for a bit to make sure you're getting enough or whatever. You know, maybe you're struggling a bit with training, so you think, actually, you know, I'm going to keep more of an eye on my carbs for a bit to make sure I'm getting on enough. Well, you know, but I think it's seeing it just as a tool and something that we can use as and when suits us, but it's not something that we have to be tied to, you know, forever. And I think that, you know, we should all feel that it's a choice that we can track or not that it's a kind of obligation, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100% on that. I think, you know, there's still a lot of noise that we have to like strictly adhere to it every single day.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not necessarily healthy, like psychologically.
No, it's not. And it's not flexible, despite what despite the term flexible dieting, it's not. You know, being chained to my fitness pal, you know. Not flexible.
I mean, like, you know, I've seen people, like, I think if you eat out often, it's good to know the calories and macros. But if you're going out for your birthday dinner, it makes me kind of sad that someone would sit and track their birthday dinner and starve themselves for the whole morning before it and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of one of those things. You're just, it takes time to sort of get used to the idea that you don't have to use it all the time.
Definitely, you know, and you can eat foods where you don't know the macros of them, you know, as well, you know, because especially a lot of vegan food, right? That stuff isn't in the app, you know?
Oh, no, over, obviously, they're having moved to Switzerland. There is quite, to be fair, there is quite a lot of stuff in my fitness pal, but not everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, the packaging's in French and German, so...
Yeah.
You know, if I can't track for whatever reason, like after Christmas I did like a little bit of tracking, just sort of get my diet on a sort of place I wanted to be. I've just finished doing that because I felt quite happy with how it's gone. But
great.
During that time, you know, I was like, well, you know, the packaging's in French and not in my fitness pal, and I can't easily see how much is in this. You know, I'm not going to beat myself up, and like, I don't have scales because we're living in a temporary apartment, so can't weigh everything. But I don't think it's a huge deal. As long as I make weight for the next competition, I'm not going to worry too much.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what you've articulated there is that you know how to eat without having to track. Do you know what I mean? Which I think is really important. You know that that we're okay eating without having to weigh and measure and track and stuff, because I think, you know, there are people who feel like they don't know how to eat, you know, without those tools. And I think it's great you've got to that place, and I think allows you a lot of flexibility, right, to be able to like move countries and, you know,
I mean, if I was strictly tracking the way I had been a year ago, it would have been my worst nightmare, because, you know, like the night I got here, you know, I wasn't going to sit there and like weigh out my food or whatever. You know, the first thing we did was go out to eat, because you get off a flight, you're shattered, you know, all the supermarkets are closed. And, you know, the like, first, if I was strictly tracking, that literally would have been my worst nightmare, because none of the food in the restaurants here is on my fitness pal.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really have as many kind of chains. They're mostly independent. So nothing has macros and calories on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, it's so important to get to that place so that you can, you know, actually enjoy food, you know, which, and, you know, food should be enjoyable, right? It's not, you know, it is fuel, but it's not just fuel, you know. And I think, you know, what I feel really passionate about is I want everyone to kind of get to a place where they're not worrying about it, so that actually then they've got that extra space in their brain for whatever else they want in their life, you know, because you can't, if you're obsessing about, you know, food and, you know, your body and, you know, exercise as well, you just can't, because that takes up so much of your energy, you know. So, you know, I just think, you know, it's so important to kind of, do this work. And, you know, it is work, absolutely, to get to that place. But, you know, there's so much on the other side of that, you know, which, I think is exciting. So, oh, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No, it's okay. It's been great. Thanks so much for having me. We've had a really interesting chat.
Yeah, I knew we would. Like, we do in person, so it's great to bring it to a podcast. So, yeah. Cool. Well, in terms of where people can find you, is Instagram the best place for people to go?
Yeah, Instagram is really, like, the best place. I'm not, like, super social media-y, so I tend to just hang out on there. So my handle is at Rachel Elizabeth Lift. My name is spelled a little bit unusually, so I'm an AEL, not an EL. So if you're searching for me, bear that in mind. But,
No, I really like your Instagram as well. Like, loads of lifting videos and wearing amazing leggings as well. Your leggings collection is amazing.
Shout out to Girl Clothing for those. They're fantastic. And actually, they're a clothing brand who have sort of an ethos that's very aligned with my own, which I think is good.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like women, all different sizes, all different shapes. And like, you know, real athletes, right? Not just people that look good in leggings. Cool. Yeah, well, I will catch up with you soon.
Super.
Bye.
I
hope you enjoyed the podcast today. I'd really appreciate it if you took 2 minutes and just gave me a review, positive or negative. I'd love to find out what you enjoyed, what you didn't, so that I can put together the best possible podcast. And it also helps it to go up in rankings so that other people can discover the podcast too. Thank you.